Welcome to Wake Up Podcast with Viv Trader. Viv is a curious person with the desire to embrace different opinions and expertise. Her focus is health, well-being, environmental, and political. She holds a non-judgmental approach and she is objective. Viv's ambition is to raise your awareness and contribute to a better world. She is also the founder of Vivalicious Food, which produces an innovative vegan baby food with added omega-3 from an algae oil. www.vivaliciousfood.com.
So today I have the real pleasure of inviting Dr. Anthony Carver. Hello, Anthony. Lovely to see you today.
Likewise. Thank you for having me on.
You look very happy and fresh, and it's morning time for you. Where are you at the moment?
Where are it's you morning here in San Francisco. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Anthony, who are you?
So I'm an anesthesiologist and an integrative medicine specialist. And these are two vastly different fields in medicine that people typically scratch their heads and say, you're an anesthesiologist. I've heard of anesthesia, but what's an integrative medicine specialist? And it's unfortunately a result of people not recognizing what anesthesia truly is, nor understanding what integrative medicine is. And in brief, anesthesia, as you know, is the process of going to sleep for surgery, to be unconscious and to not feel pain, but it's also the process of your body in some ways opening up like a book and revealing things about yourself that you may have never told anyone ever, a spouse, children, partners, friends, even a therapist sometimes. Integrative medicine is the practice of integrating all of the medical cultures and knowledge across the world, across time, to augment our traditional Western biomedical model and our Western medical practice. So looking at ancient traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine from the Indian subcontinent, and the Americas. There's plenty of wisdom that we simply don't acknowledge, partly because in the Western biomedical model, we've reduced medicine down to neurotransmitters and chemicals and pharmaceuticals, and they are very important, huge. I mean, I use them every day in my practice, but there's more. Human beings are more than just meat bags or water bags and chemicals floating around. And we need to acknowledge that, not only in the operating room, but also in our everyday life.
How did you get into this? How did you become a doctor and work with anesthesia? And what brought you into this path?
That's a very good question. Thank you. When I originally finished college, I was an engineer and I worked in a medical startup looking at devices. And this was back when Bluetooth was a thing. And we found a way to connect a heart patch to your phone over Bluetooth. And it was like amazing. You know, this is before iWatches and everything else. And we thought this is going to transform medicine. And it was transformative in many ways, but I then went to medical school at Stanford where there was still this, you know, very strong entrepreneurial spirit. But I realized very quickly that the entrepreneurial spirit that we're putting towards devices and gizmos and gadgets isn't what's actually going to help the vast majority of human beings on this planet. There's an inner healing potential that was really intriguing to me that we didn't really talk about in medical school. And I love Stanford. I learned so much and I'm so indebted to all of my teachers there. Don't get me wrong, but there was this rather confusing silence, like complete muteness on what do patients bring into the encounter with their doctor? It's not just a prescription pad and being a pill mill, not just putting them under the knife of surgery, but human beings have an innate healing potential. But we didn't talk about how to augment that, how to support it, catalyze it.
Right.
I chose to do anesthesia residency after because anesthesia still had some devices and had a lot of the fun engineering stuff. Because when you're under anesthesia, you are connected to all the monitors that we know of, that all, you know, mankind's greatest invention. So it seemed like a natural fit. But even there, what was so confusing to me is that people can go under anesthesia and then wake up with vastly different experiences. Some patients wake up. Oh, yeah. Patients can wake up kicking and screaming and crying. Other patients wake up kind of like, oh, you know, totally, we say they're gorked out. And some patients would wake up with fascinating, almost like epiphanies or discoveries and wake up with gratitude, being like, wow, I'm in a lot of pain because I had surgery, but thank you, doctor. It's not about thanking your doctors and like feeling good about us. It's about what is going on in the brain in this vulnerable time for patients where their brains are being, in some ways, heavily manipulated. And they're finding healing in ways that are beyond what the surgery itself is doing. So I discovered Andrew Weil, who was kind of the, if you will, the one that brought this concept of integrative medicine to the West. And in secret, I pursued his fellowship because, quite frankly, people made fun of me in my residency. And I did my residency at Harvard, and I loved all my teachers at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Don't, please don't misinterpret that. But even there, there was this vibe of like, oh, Anthony likes to do these kind of, he thinks about it differently. You know, it's kind of stigmatized in some ways. I didn't even tell anyone what I wanted to do, which is to look more about this mind-body connection that underlies us in the most vulnerable, scary moments of our lives. Remember, when you come to the operating room, people think you just get a mask on.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
That's just the start of what happens, though. That's just the start. Like I said, body opens like a, opens up like a book, and doctors can do much more than just heal the physical body. We can also address the mind to help the healing from surgery not only be better, but also perhaps make a longer term impact in that patient's life. And that eventually led me to the concept of psychedelics, and in specific ketamine. And that's where I do a lot of my work these days. Coming from someone who's very straight arrow, I never would have thought I would ever have any interest in psychedelics at all. But the anesthesia and psychedelics share a very interesting set of similarities. And ketamine, is being a legal medication in the United States, has allowed me to explore this with patients and help individuals find healing in ways they never thought possible. Really transformative experiences inside and outside the operating room.
What is the most amazing healing story you have heard throughout your years? What is it like the most amazing feedback you have gotten so far? It sounds amazing. We're going to dig a little bit deeper soon, but I just want to hear
that. Absolutely. That's, I wish I could give, I mean, there's so many. The one that comes to mind, and this is really what prompted me to explore the concept of psychedelic experiences outside the operating room, was when a patient, I call my patients the night before surgery. I called her the night before surgery, and she was having a very routine knee surgery. But one of my questions was about any history of strokes. And she said that she had not a stroke, but had some neurological problem that involved paralysis of her arm and leg. And this can have profound concerns under anesthesia. So I had to dig a little bit more and ask her some more questions. This is all the night before. I haven't seen her yet.
Right.
And the story that I was hearing, she had been to Stanford and seen all the neurologists there. No one had been able to give her a diagnosis for what the problem was. But, you know, after years and years and years of speaking with patients, you kind of pick up on some subtle clues, and they could sense something in her voice that this was not just like a car accident. It was not just a, you know, sudden multiple sclerosis type of thing. There's something, there was an emotional component to it, I strongly suspected, just from her voice. Fast forward to the next day. And before I interview her, before, of course, we go under anesthesia, I examine her. None of the story sounds like an infection or a stroke or any type of neurodegenerative disease. It turns out that it had come after a serious trauma in this patient's life, a very serious emotional trauma where she just kind of gone limp, essentially, on one side of her body, which to me has all the telltale signs of what we call conversion disorder. I did not tell this to the patient, and this is the key. I just took note of this, made an assessment for the anesthesia risks, went to sleep. We woke up. And the first thing the patient told me when they woke up, she looked me in the eye. She said, "Doc, I think I have conversion disorder." So I took note of this. When patients wake up from anesthesia, they're not typically, not all the light bulbs aren't shining yet. It takes time for the memory centers of the brain to turn back on, to remember conversations, et cetera. But I called her 2 days later, checked up on her, make sure she was doing well from the knee surgery, and she was. But I said, "Do you remember the very first thing you told me when you looked me in the eyes when you woke up?" She said, no, I have no idea. What did I say? Mm-hmm. And I said, you told me that you think you have conversion disorder. Remember, I never used those words with her. And I wish I could have seen her expression, because I think her jaw dropped to the floor, because she said, I said, what to you? It's like, what do you know about conversion disorder? Why did you say this? She's like, nobody, and remember, this is someone who for years has seen every specialist under the sun, and nobody seems to have actually connected the dots of like, well, serious trauma, every test is negative, and you have a major neurologic deficit, seemingly. But there's no organic, what we call, you know, there's no MRI abnormalities, no blood test abnormalities. Nobody had told this poor lady that maybe there is a mind-body reason. I'm not saying she's faking it. Don't take it that way. It accentuates just how powerful the mind-body connection is. And this patient called me like 6 months later and said, what you told me after. And by the way, this, I didn't do anything. I just asked questions out of curiosity. I didn't do any healing per se. I just was present with the patient. That's all I had to do. She called me months later and said, Doc, you wouldn't believe how much my life has changed. Not only has her function begun to return, but she's actually seen mental health professionals who have been able to explain this process of conversion disorder. She had done some research on this before, so she knew the word. But something in that experience, talking about the trauma with me in probably greater depth than any other doctor before, having anesthesia, feeling trusted by the, you know, trusting the surgeon, trusting me, et cetera, waking up in a comfortable situation allowed some gears to catalyze her brain so that after like literally 10 years of being stuck with this horrible deficit has changed her life. I mean,
amazing.
Anyway, imagine that story like every other week in the operating room and now every other day when we use ketamine for healing. And that's the type of immense satisfaction that I never found in the standard, if you will, biomedical reductionist model.
Really amazing. It's mind blowing. What comes to mind now is, you know, a lot of people have this, you know, I've been following a podcast with lots of stories about people that passed over. And I talked about this with Stephen Washington in my past podcast interview as well. People that have passed over and coming back to life. And then it has, during being under anesthesia, left their lives and then entered back into to this earthly life. And they all have a common theme. They feel this unconditional love. They have a vast knowledge. They know everything. They have a 360 degrees turnaround of vision. They say we're all from the same source. We are all one. We don't want to go back to Earth. It's too dense, too heavy. I want to stay here. They connect with loved ones, even pets. Have you come across any patients like that that's passed over in your work?
Very good question. Unfortunately, you know, when someone passes over or crosses over, it's, if they truly cross over, it's a one-way street. But there are individuals that have, you know, anesthesia. Anesthesia is a medical coma. You are on the verge of life and death at every moment. It's why we're connecting patients to these life support monitors, to ventilators, because, you know, one dose off by 10% and they could be on the other side. Or if there's a major surgical complication, they can be on the other side. So we're not quite crossing over, but we're on the doorsteps. It's why we train for decades at this, to keep us from crossing over. There are experiences that I hear, however, it is far more common. And what you said, by the way, is exactly dead on. The problem with anesthesia is that we often give medications that scramble memory formation. So even if they experience something like that, their memories are, the frontal lobes, the hippocampus, et cetera, are not orchestrated properly to actually retain those memories. However, in my ketamine infusion clinic, we purposely do not give medications that scramble memories, because we want patients to remember what you so elegantly just said. And those types of expansive consciousness, interconnectedness, love, forgiveness, gratitude are pervasive emotions that people regularly express, especially towards events and traumas and people that they perhaps never thought they would be able to express those towards because of some element of cognitive rigidity, being stuck, being unwilling to forgive, et cetera. And you're familiar with this, but what's equally amazing is that cultures all over the world have expressed this in their artwork and their poetry, et cetera, for thousands of years. So none of this is new, but we do have a new lens of being able to access this in individuals because we have medications like ketamine, like anesthetics. And most importantly, we have trusted patient-doctor relationships that allow this to come out.
And throughout your work as well, you have sort of experienced that there is sort of a loneliness epidemic going on as well that's not been much talked about. I mean, we talk about mental health and but you were saying like Generation Z or Y are a lonely generation. Is that correct? Am I correct? Have you had those findings in your work?
Generation Z is fascinating. They live on the double-edged sword. Many of them, unfortunately, fall on the side of succumbing to the predatory behaviors of instantaneous gratification, intermittent reward that are pervasive on social media, in the online shopping, gambling, etc. However, there's also some that are able to take the best of the digital world. You know, we call them digital natives because they grew up because of the year that they grew up. They never knew a life. Like you and I, we remember life before the internet. We remember life before cell phones. So there are some that are able to take advantage of being this digital native and be able to use all of the world's resources that are at their fingertips, at their phone, to be able to jumpstart the process of gaining wisdom. Remember, wisdom is knowledge plus experience. So with all of technology that they have access to and they know how to access, they can get that knowledge so much faster than you or I ever could. You know, imagine going to the library and going through like those little cards to... Ones that are able to keep the dose in moderation of these digital tools can blow other generations away, not only in controlling and being empowered for their mental health, but also their physical health. And classic examples are, if I'm doing a procedure, I wish I had the needle to show you, but like sometimes you have to place rather long needles in patients, whether they're epidurals, spinals, or nerve blocks. Oftentimes for a nerve block, I'm not even joking with you, I want to call them children, but I guess they're adolescents or young adults. They will be on their phone texting or whatever social media posting while I'm doing the procedure on them. And this just blows my mind because for one, I need you to be engaged with me so that if there's a complication, you tell me right away because that alters what I do in performing the procedure. But number two, it's just like checked out. There's this level of distraction because Generation Z, as you know, has experienced things that you and I have not experienced in our formative years in adolescence between COVID, between all this hate speech, especially in the United States, social media just making this fomenting these horrible interactions of hate online. So they've been exposed to things that are horrible, but they in the fight, flight, or freeze response, they're kind of like in flight mode, right? These maladaptive coping mechanisms come out when they're vulnerable in surgery because they don't have the wisdom. And I'm not blaming them. I'm just being honest, right? They're like 20-year-olds. How do they? They've never had surgery before. They've never seen people. Hopefully, they haven't seen many people die in hospitals. They don't know. They just check out mentally. Another thing, when I call patients the night before, they have a tendency in the United States specifically not to grab booze, but they are quick to reach for sleep aids and weed. Study after study shows this. And more than once and twice and three times, I've called patients the night before surgery who are in this Generation Z. And, you know, I say, Dr. Kaveh, I'm going to be your anesthesiologist tomorrow. I want to speak with you about your surgery. And they're like, okay. So they go through everything. And at the end, they're like, so am I going to be asleep for the surgery? And I was like, were you there for any of this? The next day, they're like, you know, doc, I'm really sorry. I was kind of smoking a joint with some friends when you called. And I mean, I understand that people get anxious before surgery. That's totally understandable. But to think that it's okay to have a serious conversation with somebody who is in charge of your life you know, in the delicate process of surgery and not acknowledge that, hey, I'm high right now. Can I call you back when I'm sober again? You know, it's just like this tendency to grab for the quick fixes or what we call the cheap back doors.
Mm-hmm.
Substance abuse, right, is one of the maladaptive coping mechanisms.
Right.
Every generation has substance abuse problems, but gosh, it is the lack of, I don't want to say maturity in a pejorative way, but it's, these are young people. They haven't had those life experiences to figure out, oh, I'm having surgery tomorrow. For one, I shouldn't be smoking the joint in the first place. But two, if my doctor's calling, I need to, you know, this is not just like a joke conversation here.
Mm-hmm. Like respect. It's like they're in this flight, you know, flight mode. So what's happening right now is more important than thinking about what's happening tomorrow. Taking responsibility, you know.
Being present is what I find. What you said is absolutely correct, but just being in the moment and present and mindful. Every generation is, of course, you know, can fall prey to this, but this generation has grown up not having to be present, unfortunately. And it shows, remember, surgery is like the pressure cooker where all of the negative qualities come up. So I don't want to pick on Generation Z, but gosh, they're going to have a hard time moving forward.
So what do you think we need to do to help them? I mean, what we don't want to have a generation growing up not being present, you know? It's going to have quite severe consequences in many areas.
What I would love to know your thoughts. What do you think? I mean, I'm sure in your area, you don't live in San Francisco. Maybe we live in a bubble where tech, you know, rules everyone's lives here.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I am, you know, a parent. I'm a single mom of three kids and it's very busy. I have an 18-year-old, 14-year-old, 12-year-old. But my 12-year-old daughter, she's into horses. So we're in the stables a lot of time. She spends a lot of time outside. My middle son plays football. It's, you know, he's a lot in front of the screen. They connect through the screens, play the games. And my 18-year-old, he is not into drugs, thankfully, but he is going to the gym, you know, sleeping a lot, focusing on his studies. But I think the positive things of being a single mom for me is that I am more present with my children because I don't have a partner to talk to. I'm there with them. You know, I don't have to talk to someone else and they are in the back burner, like from my experience. And I think when I do spend my time with them, I try to be as present as possible because my parents weren't present and I know how much trauma that inflicted in my life and how much I have suffered. And I don't want to pass that on to my children. So I worked, you know, I worked on myself and sort of hopefully healed most of my traumas so I don't pass them on to my children. And we talk, you know, we talk about emotions, we talk about feelings, we talk about different viewpoints. There's no judgment, you know, you just try and be, you know, present, I think, and be a role model, but not just for my kids, but for everyone around me. And I think, you know, when you're present as well, that's, you know, I said it before, but that's where the magic happens. That's where you have this, you know, amazing connection with another human being. It's certainly not through, you know, being up here.
Wow, so beautifully said. Thank you for sharing that perspective.
No, that's sorry, but that's, you know, I think, you know, we need to, you know, be open and share. I think having trauma, we all have trauma in a way or another. It's, we don't need to be ashamed of it. It's just, we're just human beings, you know. No one is perfect. And I think we need to get rid of that stigma. They're shameful to talk about emotions and feelings, and because it's not, you know, that's how we heal.
Well said. I'm of course sorry to hear about your experiences, and I certainly agree on the presence component. Carol Dweck out of Stanford, very, and I'm sure you're familiar with what she's brought to the field about growth mindsets. And she has this quote that I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but I think that I agree with her in that she says the single most valuable gift a parent can give their child is a love for challenges, an eagerness for learning and putting themselves out there, pushing the boundaries and not being afraid of failure. And we live in a society where nowadays it's almost the exact opposite. We just want to stay in our comfort zone. Anytime we veer out, we're afraid of I don't want to be naive about it, but having thin skin and being traumatized or hurt. And it's, people don't recognize that it's not the event that causes trauma. It's our response to the event. I mean, yes. I know you know this, right?
For sure.
But,
yeah.
But a younger generation that has not had the wisdom or experience has not been out there. I liken it to athletes often, because in my work, pain, I mean, physical and mental pain are one and the same, which is its own discussion that no one wants to hear, but it's unfortunately the medical truth that pain is 100% in the brain, 100% unequivocally case closed. But when people don't know their bodies, they, any slight discomfort, oh my gosh, is something wrong with me? And they come to the doctor's office and it's a lot of reassurance. And there's nothing wrong with reassurance, but compare this in my experience with athletes who have, for in all their youth, they know what it's like to pull a muscle versus bang a shoulder or an elbow. They know their bodies in ways that they're not afraid to push the boundaries. Now, that's for the physical body and the mental body, but we need all children to know what they're truly, where the boundaries are, to not be afraid to push the envelope. Because if they fear, you know, fears, uncertainties, and doubts, pretty much are present in one form or another in every patient that comes to me. And when they take hold of our bodies, we can't escape. They just dig these grooves deeper and deeper and deeper. And largely they come from our self-imposed limitations. So,
And you were saying that pain is in your head. Is that you fabricate pain throughout your thoughts?
Well, then we'll talk about this. This is, it's a very triggering topic for so many patients. And it saddens me that it is, because it does disservice to appreciation of our mind and body connection. And this is one of my teachers, by the way, when I was a resident, told me, and I am so grateful that he broke this myth down. Pain is 100% in the brain. We know this is absolutely true, because you can have tissue damage and not feel pain. And you can feel pain in the absence of any tissue damage. Pain is like taste. You know, you and I can have a meal prepared by the same chef at the same time on the same day, and you might think that it's amazing. And I might think like, oh, I don't really like this, you know, this delicacy of Sweden. I just thought it's gross, right? It doesn't mean that you and I are wrong, right? But the brain is responding to a stimuli in a different way based on any number of past conditionings, narratives, history, et cetera. Once again, it's not wrong, right? But the brain needs to be present to process the stimulus of pain, and how the brain processes it determines our perception of pain. If you don't have a brain, you can chop off all your fingers, you're not going to feel pain. You need to have a brain to feel pain. Doesn't mean that pain is not real, but it means that there's a tremendous amount of modulation that happens in the brain. So it's not about disempowering or gaslighting anyone. And everyone immediately thinks, oh, Dr. Kav is gaslighting me. No, I want you to know that you have more power over your body's perception of pain than you ever thought. It doesn't mean that it's, I mean, yes, it is all in your head, but there's very real mechanisms that happen everywhere in the nerves, from anywhere where the tissue trauma is happening through your spinal cord, brainstem, and ultimately your cerebral cortex that is processing that. And if you try to only look at what's out here in the tissue trauma, you're going to ignore the vast majority of what's going on. You end up with things like an opiate epidemic, like people who have kidney failure from taking too much ibuprofen, et cetera, a liver failure from Tylenol, or outside acetaminophen or paracetamol. But the point is that if we don't acknowledge that our mental health and our psychological state affects our perception of pain, we're doing ourselves a disservice. And likewise, our physical body state affects our psychological state. You can't heal your psychological state without healing the physical body, and vice versa. It's all I'm trying to say. It's not meant to be triggering at all.
Wow, that's very, very profound. So you can literally decide how you want to feel. How do I want to feel? Do I want to feel good? Yes, start thinking good thoughts that will serve you. And perhaps work on your faith then.
of course, there's, you know, these are nuanced discussions and every individual is different, but absolutely, we know that the mindset that we bring in to surgery, which is a controlled trauma, for goodness sakes, you're cutting people open. You know, I'll tell you something that to me, it seems obvious, but I don't blame people for not recognizing this. You can ask any surgeon, and I encourage any one of your viewers to ask a surgeon if they can, how they know who is going to do well after surgery. And if it's a surgeon who's been around the block for a couple of years, they will tell you that, yes, it depends on what the problem is with their body that they're coming into the operating room for. That's certainly part of it. But they can often tell you before the surgery has even started who is going to be happy with the result and who's going to not be happy based on their mindset. Meaning that you could come in, and I should say I'm referring mostly to surgeries that are trying to relieve pain. So often orthopedic surgeons have very good insight, very good insight. They know you could have, let's say, the most busted up elbow in the world.
Yeah.
But if you come in with one of these rigid mindsets, which we can talk about, but you can have the best surgery, you're still going to have pain. Or you could come in for a tiny little small scratch, or pardon, I could say you could come in, you know, for the same surgery, but with one of the other more cognitively flexible mindsets, tolerant of ambiguity, tolerant of uncertainty, and have a much more minor surgery and have a better result than someone who had the major reconstruction. For example, showing that the physical, the tissue trauma is only one part of the perception of pain. I'm not gaslighting. Pain is real. But there is a top-down modulation that we need to recognize and respect because it's very, very powerful.
And I know as well that if you have unresolved feelings, emotions, and traumas, they can actually manifest in your body like a sore arm, sore back, if you don't deal with your emotions, right?
Well, that was a conversion disorder in that patient who their whole side of their body was limp after that. Horrible. It was the loss of a child. That was the type of trauma that they had to that they had dealt with.
Wow.
That caused, and conversion disorder is going to be the extreme. I mean, these are rare cases where people have literally loss of function of an arm or a leg, or numbness, seizures, memory loss, etc., where the something about the psychogenic aspect is hijacking your central nervous system in a way that is, for all intents and purposes, you look like you've had a stroke. And these are real. They are very rare. You know, we see it actually, you know, a major trauma as well as child loss. So you can, you know, there's this this condition, pseudocyesis, where women who have lost a child can actually still have abdominal swelling and swelling as if they are still pregnant. There's no fetus in there. And some of it might be from swallowing air unintentionally. We don't understand. These are relatively rare, but they are very well documented. You put them under anesthesia, the whole belly can sometimes deflate. It's very, very, very curious, right? But something else about trauma and that the concept of pain, there's one patient population that is unique amongst all of my patients in the operating room. And that's women coming in for cesarean sections. And I think this also really goes to what you just mentioned about traumas and how our body manifests them, whether it's soreness or pain or in those extreme cases, conversion disorders. When women come in for cesarean sections, we rarely put women fully to sleep for general anesthesia for many reasons. One, we don't want to give them anesthetic drugs that might overdose the fetus. Yeah. We don't want a baby to be born not breathing and overdosed on, you know, it's not, not a good look to have a blue baby. We also, there's maternal risks to going under general anesthesia when you are full-term pregnant. So we usually do spinals and epidurals, as I'm sure you and your viewers are aware, because we don't want to put someone fully to sleep. However, we do spinals and epidurals for many other surgeries as well. Hip replacements, knee replacements, prostate surgeries, many, many surgeries. The big difference is that when I'm doing, let's say, a spinal anesthetic, so I'm putting the needle in their back, numbing them profoundly from the belly button downwards, so they're insensate for a couple of hours, I still give them a good dose of IV anesthesia. So they're still snoozing really hard. But for women, like we said, we don't want to give them anything unless they absolutely need it, because that's going to go into the baby's brain. And we don't want the baby. I mean, even though it's likely going to be safe, we don't want to take a risk. One, and two, we don't want to rob that woman of the experience of their childbirth, especially if it's something that they've been looking forward to. So we don't want to give them medications that scramble their memories in their IV. So we effectively just do a spinal and that's it. No other medications. But I said in older patients, like hip and knee and whatever surgeries, we're giving them a ton of medications. Why is it that women at childbirth tolerate this, having their abdomen cut open and this, you know, baby being pulled out of the uterus? It's a pretty massive surgery, as any woman will know. I believe that the profound difference that women tolerate this and they don't want any medication versus the older people that want the medication is that women have had, 9 months to prepare for this? Their mindset is completely there. We were talking about loneliness before we started, and how many patients come in with a loss of purpose, direction, fulfillment when they're lonely, because loneliness has this profound effect on our psyche. And it's often older people who are coming in for knee and hip replacements. And when these older individuals come in, if they're lonely, they might be like, you know, my knee hurts and I want to get back to walking and I kind of want this knee replacement. It's so like, versus that woman, that woman who is like, I want my baby. I want to hold my baby.
Of course you do. Super exciting. Yeah.
Right? You tell me that mindset difference and how much it influences them not even needing any IV anesthesia to be sedated and relaxed for invasive surgeries. You see how much that mindset can make or break that surgery? Isn't that incredible?
Very interesting parallels. Never thought about it that way before, but you're right. Spot on. But since they're not so common, you know, it's so normalized that we are awake. You don't think it's second thought about it. Why are we awake? Very profound. Really, you know, it is true. Why are we so strong? Because, you know, it's probably the most exciting moment in our lives, you know.
Right?
So that mindset you wouldn't even question it, you know. Why would you want to be asleep? It's true.
Would you mind my asking, did you have cesarean sections or vaginal deliveries?
But I was induced. My first one was like a week late, and he was very, you know, a large baby. And then my middle one, he was also induced. And my third one, then my doctor said, well, we are going to induce you because we know. You know, but it was nice. It was a normal birth and I had epidurals in all three. Thank goodness. and it was, you know, my first labor was very traumatic. It took a long time and I was quite stressed and I had quite a bit of fear of the whole procedure. My second one, I had no fear at all. And my third one, it was like completely no fear. Just get it done with. So it is amazing with your brain how you go from having that experience, having gone through it. And I think most mothers that are about to give birth the first time are, you know, it is scary because you don't know what to expect because you haven't been through it. And of course, it's super exciting at the same time. And then once you've done it, you know, if you're lucky, I mean, you can have complications, of course, but in most cases. Do you see any difference from cesarean versus giving a natural birth? Is there any differences, you know, in terms of the help for the baby, or is it just equal? Or
sure. It's a very good question, but I just want to go back to what you said very briefly. You said how you were saying how women have this resolve. They're so excited. They're looking forward to it, right? And it shows in how their body and how their mind responds to that surgical stress. So what's curious to me is why don't we talk about this outside of the labor and delivery floor? What if patients came with that same resolve for their knee replacement? What if we had that same resolve and that excitement for making new friends? putting ourselves in uncomfortable situations. I mean, you said yourself, you're terrified before your first delivery, but you have all this. How can we push ourselves out of our comfort zones, right? And how much better could we do it if we had that same mindset that you just so beautifully shared before childbirth, right? That's one of the sad parts to this whole loneliness epidemic that underlies in many ways the opioid epidemic in the United States and so much more about the mental health crisis that all over the world people are facing. We don't have this direction, presence of mind to appreciate what is our direction, what is our end goal. But thank you for mentioning it that way. Very well said. To answer your question about children, their risks when they're born vaginally versus via cesarean section, the greatest confounder is that if a child is born via cesarean section, there may have been something wrong in the first place. So you can't, it might mean you're impossible to ever tease apart. Is it safer for a vaginal birth versus a cesarean section? Of course, a vaginal birth will avoid many of the long-term potential risks in the mother, because anytime you have abdominal surgery, you have risks of scar tissue forming in unnatural ways that can cause problems. Blood loss risks, so on and so forth. But oftentimes, if a child can be born vaginally, there's very little reason to artificially do it via cesarean section. It's often because there's a medical reason. So that might influence why more children go to the ICU after cesarean section than versus a normal vaginal delivery. Mm-hmm. Very good question.
Oh, thank you, and very good answer as well. Now, Dr. Anthony, what is the biggest fear you have had in your life or have?
The greatest fear. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before. That's a good question. There's a saying they taught us in residency. They said that, and I agree with it. They said that doctors are never afraid or worried. They are concerned. Right? So it's funny. I have many fears, uncertainties, and doubts, but they are in the context of something greater, in my greater belief, meaning that, and by the way, every culture around the world has this belief in some shape or form that life is cyclic, analogous to cycles of the moon, cycles of the seasons, circle of life, etc. Whenever we are in places that are challenging, trials, tribulations, etc., we're going to be at nadirs, and they're going to be followed inevitably by some lessening of that tension, lessening of that hardship. My fear is losing, if you will, faith in that greater context, because I believe that if we have faith in something greater than ourselves, we can overcome the ups and downs that life inevitably will throw at us. At you, just like me, just like all of my patients, we're going to have horrible event things happen to us. We hope or pray or do daily practices to strengthen ourselves internally so that we have the internal support and the resilience to face those challenges and not fight, flight, or freeze in their face, but to actually face them head on. Losing that faith, which happens to many patients, it doesn't have to be a religious faith. It can be whatever kind of faith you want, but faith in something greater than just your three-dimensional existence. Losing that can underlie a lot of hardship that I see in patients. And I would fear losing that. I hope that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, human beings, we all have, a growth. Life is about growth, I think. We're here to grow, learn, and experience hardship, joy, happiness, all of it. And no one can escape it. But then how you deal with your hardships and challenges, it's up to each one of us and the richer life you want to have, I think, personally. You will have to deal with, get to know yourself, build a relationship with yourself, practice self-love, become more focused on what you need, not what others think of you, and let go of others' expectations of you and be your own driver. Because then from my own journey as well, that led me to become authentic and genuine and honest, and so worth it. Just peeling off the masks, I think.
Very well said. And that is something that I kind of wanted to say, but you brought it up about the concept of ego. Mm-hmm. And in the psychedelic journey with ketamine or in meditative experience, this is not relegated. This is not only with mushrooms and MDMA. And I always tell patients that while this is what I offer, it's by no means the only way of being able to have these types of experiences to lead to that richer life that you were describing. Cultures and people around the world forever have attained that level of certainty and confidence and peace and direction and calmness, serenity, happiness, etc., without any substances, time and time and time again for thousands of years. They are not by any means necessary. However, in some individuals, they can be greatly powerful at the right time with the right ethical, responsible use. But they all have the same concept of recognizing that our ego instills those fears, uncertainties, and doubts, not mm-hmm. being able to be our authentic self, stand up for our values. And I had this yesterday in the operating room. Hard things happen with patients where I have to make decisions between canceling a surgery, which is, of course, the patient doesn't want to hear that. The surgeon does not want to hear that. The hospital doesn't want to hear that. But it's like, I have to do the right thing, even if it's going to make me incredibly unpopular and risk people being upset at me. It sounds on paper like a very easy decision to make, but in practice, it's very, very hard. And of course, I think we should all have a healthy fear, not a crippling fear, but a fear that we're vulnerable, like you said, and we're vulnerable to making mistakes and falling prey to our ego. And that is something that I personally fear, that I suspect I'm not the only one with that fear.
No, the ego does nothing good. I mean, it's good to have an ego. Of course, we all have egos, was in for me. But I think when the ego becomes too large and takes over, you know, we can, you know, narcissism, and we all have, you know, but it's very destructive to have too big of an ego, I think, personally. All right, time flies, Anthony. Now, where do you hope we are in 10 years in the world from your viewpoint and your work? And your legacy?
I have no legacy. It's about hopefully the message that you were sharing right now, and I'm supporting you in sharing that we have greater control and agency over our lives and in our connections with others. Those kind of those near-death experiences that you shared, they can be experienced without having to be on the operating room table, without having to have ketamine or mushrooms or have to almost die in a river and drown. You know, we can have these experiences mindfully if we are present with ourselves. Yes, they take time. They're not going to be as fast as getting psilocybin and within, you know, 24 hours having your life completely changed. I'm not saying that's good or bad, but we can have these completely naturally for those of us that don't want to choose that path. Mm-hmm. And it will help us not only be healthier for ourselves, but be more connected with others to help others be more healthy. And I think it's curious that the values that ancient cultures have just ingrained into their population's minds before the rise of, I guess, Western society kind of overthrowing that, is so aligned with the tenets of good medicine. Respect, putting others' needs first when possible, mm-hmm. treating others the way you want to be treated, being present, being compassionate. I mean, this is what I learned in kindergarten. And is it a coincidence that these are the same tenets that the people that live longest in the world and live healthiest in the world and have the greatest sense of satisfaction and fulfillment all subscribe to? I don't think it's a coincidence that the healthiest people are the ones that embrace these values the strongest. Of course, there are exceptions, right? Of course, everything is nuanced in medicine.
But yeah, but I agree with you. Good point. I mean, people in the most, you know, poorest countries as well have the biggest hearts and are so generous, and, you know, although they don't have much, they give so much. Yeah. A good point. Thank you very, very much for coming and sharing your expertise, your wonderful personality. You have so much passion. It was super exciting having you here today and hearing all about your journey and what you are doing an amazing work, obviously, with spreading mental health awareness into the world. Great healer.
Well, as are you. Thank you for what you do, and please don't stop. And I hope all of your viewers feel that inspiration to not only help themselves be healthier and discover their fulfillment and passions, but also help those around them.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you got some valuable information today. Wake up, wake up. And thanks for checking in and waking up. See you next time.